You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans, and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change, and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello, everyone. You may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast, Mystery of Everything, available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, y'all. Spooky season is here. And if you're looking for a show to whet your appetite for a little haunted history, then I'd like to invite you to check out Southern Gothic, a chart-topping history podcast that explores some of the most infamous legends, folklore, ghost stories, and hauntings of the American South. We've covered all sorts of stuff from the Bell Witch of Tennessee to the disappearance of the Confederate submarine, the H.L. Hunley, not to mention our deep dives into the local lore of some of America's oldest and most haunted cities, like New Orleans, Charleston, and St. Augustine. So, if you're ready for a little good old-fashioned Halloween storytelling with a commitment to quality historical research, then be sure to check out Southern Gothic today. It's available now on all your favorite podcast apps.
Monster House presents...
At Monster Talk, we're always looking into mysteries, but there's one mystery which only you can provide the answer for. Who are you? Airwave Media is doing a network-wide audience survey, and we would love to learn more about you, our listeners, the people who make this show possible with your support and attention. Just go to surveymonkey.com/r/airwave, all one word. So that's surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. But don't worry, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Select Monster Talk from the drop-down list of shows and then fill out the simple question to tell us more about who you are. We hope to hear from you. That's surveymonkey.com/r/airwave. Thanks.
The seven dreaded gateways are concealed in seven cursed places. Woe be unto him who ventures near without knowledge.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stoltzner.
The idea of hell is complicated. Some religions see it as a spiritual plane of divine punishment. Others see it as just the place you go when you die, regardless of your faith. In classical Greece, myths told of crossing the river Styx by paying the ferryman Charon with a coin. The dead were expected to have such a coin placed in their mouth as part of proper burial practice. Myth and folklore about holes that lead to hell are tied up with real-life locales with peculiar geology, geography, or historical significance. And then again, there are alleged gates to hell seemingly in the middle of nowhere. In medieval Europe, these doorways to hell were often symbolically drawn as literally the gaping maw of some terrible creature's mouth. Literally, a hell mouth was a mouth that opened a path to hell. But in the 1990s, a TV show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer made it part of American folklore that Hellmouth's just another name for a gate to hell. And Then there's these very numerically specific legends about how many of these gates of hell are supposed to exist. It's complicated, and it spans the globe. All around the world are stories of caverns and portals, and today we're going to hear about some of the ways these have been represented across the centuries. We're excited to have back on Al Ridenour, who's an author and a podcaster, and today is going to take us to hell. Tonight, we're talking once again to Al Ridenour, host of the wonderful and informative weird podcast, Bone and Sickle, and author of the incredible collection of Krampus folklore that is his book, The Krampus and the Old Dark Christmas. Tonight, we're going to dance around the very maw to the netherworld as we discuss hellmouths and gates to hell. So welcome back to Monster Talk, Al Ridenour.
Welcome.
Hello. This is where I say hello.
Well, Al, the reason I invited you on, besides the fact that we just love you, is you recently covered hellmouths on Bone and Sickle. That's your podcast, in case you didn't hear that in the intro. And I certainly recommend folks check out your show, because you do a wonderful presentation on this topic, which we won't be able to sort of emulate. And I wouldn't want to, because you've got your style, we've got ours. But for today, I do want to pass some of that learning on to our audience. Could you tell our audience, what is a hellmouth?
Oddly enough, the show you're talking about was a Christmas show, because the devil and representations of the devil theatrically was a Christmas phenomenon, particularly a couple other times a year. But especially on Christmas, you'd see the devil on medieval stages. And the hellmouth would be his entrance and exit, the bit of stage, a bit of scenery that he would go in and out of, and he and his demons, I should say. Either sinners would be dragged into it, or the devil and his demons might come out of it. And this is so this would be in mystery plays, which would be running from the like the 9th century up into the 16th. And so these hellmouths was a very sort of elaborate bit of scenery that was built onto a pageant wagon. The way these plays were presented, the plays actually would last all day sometimes. And the rather than running as the wagons might in a procession, a parade, the audience would go from wagon to wagon. And when hell was part of the play, when the demons or devils would enter or exit, you would have this maw, this mouth built up on the stage. And they were based on ideas that people knew already from illuminations, from manuscript illuminations. That was sort of, or carvings. That was how the entrance to hell was represented, as in sort of a monster's mouth. I just was looking through notes today, and I saw some that typically what you see is you see this monster's mouth, and then above that it's part of the mouth, sort of like the gateway to a castle, and then the angels representing heaven would be in the towers above. People would come and go, and these hellmouths were actually really elaborate. You know, these plays were presented in Latin. You know, the peasants didn't know Latin, so you had to make sure the show was fun, and that would mean they would spend a lot of money producing all the kind of special effects for these. There was a person called the Master of Secrets, who was the special effects wizard of the day, and they were in charge of pyrotechnics. They're in charge of representing Noah's flood, or representing the Satan in the Garden of Eden, and creating the hellmouths. And so we have lots of documents of, we don't have any drawings of these. Well, there's actually one from the 16th century, but there aren't a lot of visual representations, but you can tell from looking back through the town's accounts, basically what they spent money on. And there's a lot of money spent on pyrotechnics. There was some sort of belching fire that would come out of the hellmouth, and once the devils made their entrance or exit, and also lots of noise making. I have a quote from the 15th century to talk about noises made by machines. The cannons are shot off, and the flames of fire are thrown from the nostrils, eyes, and ears. So it sounds like a good show. But also beyond that, it would be sometimes the mouth would be made to look more like an actual beast's mouth. So there would be like a moving jaw, perhaps. I have an account from the 15th century. They talk about the mouth opening and closing And when the devil says, when the devils wanted to go in and out, this great head had two steel eyes, which glittered wonderfully. And I imagine them kind of rolling back and forth. So they were mechanized. Some of these could be actually really large, especially later after the days of the mystery play. So there would be still be in carnival or other processions for Corpus Christi, there would be representations of hell or in plays. And I have another 16th century account where they talk about hell created 14 feet long of rock crown with a tower ever burning and belching flames, wherein Lucifer's head and body alone appeared, vomiting flames of fire, unceasing and holding in his hand certain kinds of serpents or vipers, which writhed and belched fire. So, you know, pretty elaborate. Sounds like it would be the highlight of the show for a lot of people.
Very Christmassy.
Well, I talked about it because it's part of my sort of setting the stage for how the Krampus appears and what he looked like and how people were, the general populace was fascinated by these devils. They were actually really kind of often comic characters. And they also the costumes that they devised for these devils also often incorporated pyrotechnics. So there were there's a 16th century French manual that talks about how to create different effects, and they talk about a mask with a beak that has live coals in it, and the straws that blow. You're supposed to blow. I think it says it blows powdered sulfur and alcohol out, which makes blasts of fire.
It's funny because when I don't know if I told you this or not, but when I was listening to your episode about that and you got to the part about blowing out the fire with the sulfur and alcohol, I literally pulled over my truck and wrote an email because Mike Dash has been doing extensive research on Spring Hill Jack.
Yeah. And
one of the things we were discussing, he was still trying to kind of get to the bottom of was flame, you know, typical people use things like kerosene flammables for fire, you know, fire swallowing, fire breathing, that kind of stuff. And those are orangish yellow flames.
Yeah.
And he was trying to find out what he could, you know, what might someone use to blow blue flame, because that's what the Spring Hill Jack was supposed to do. And when you read that description, I was like, holy crap. I wrote Mike and told him all about it.
Yeah. And it has a low burning temperature, I think, too.
Yeah.
I guess these masks were also insulated with mud, actually, is what it says. But I guess, and then I don't think the Spring Hill Jack would have had the sulfur. I don't think I guess if it's powdered, I don't know how it's combined with the liquid, but the powdered sulfur would have the smell.
Probably not. And in fact, it turns out alcohol burns blue anyway. And that, so it's a great match. I just didn't know that. Neither did Mike. So
it's kind of a dim flame. I don't know if that would have really worked well. Maybe it was all theoretical what they wrote in this book. But anyway, I like the idea that they were at least thinking about it.
So, Al, I've heard of the Chester mystery plays before. So you've mentioned mystery plays, and these were performances of biblical stories. So I'd never heard of hell mouths being attached to them, though. But I wonder if you can tell us a little bit more about mystery plays.
The mystery plays were any story from the Bible. Later, there were another set of plays that appeared. They were called miracle plays that were associated with saints' lives. And then later there were everyman plays that were sort of, these weren't from the Bible. They were sort of modern dilemmas of the day what people might face. And it's from the everyman plays that get the sort of trope of the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. And that actually happens to be like a source for the Krampus, the Nicholas plays that became the Krampus. But we're not talking about that this week. But yeah, so those are a little later. So there's, evolution of these plays. And then a lot of this stuff survived in sort of carnival traditions and popular plays. But all of this is sort of a progression from within the church. There were early on, there's some sort of kind of liturgical plays that happened in the church that kind of mimed, like at Easter, there would be a sort of miming of the nailing the Christ on the cross. And then these things became more elaborate. And then the guilds took them over, and they were produced outside the church on, say, originally maybe on the steps of the church. And then later on in the court, the town square, or even sort of as on a smaller scale going house to house. That's, and again, where the Krampus comes in. But we're not talking about that either again.
These are different from Mr. T plays, and I pity the fool that gets confused.
So, Al, what is the difference between a hellmouth and a gate to hell?
The hellmouth, you have in that the idea of an animal actually swallowing the sinners. By the 19th century, the Leviathan, which I know you guys have talked about, this sort of Mesopotamian early Hebrew monster that was a kind of creature of the primordial sea, had become a demon. So it was associated with hell. And this also was associated with the story of Jonah and the whale. Christ talks about him in some verse in the New Testament. What he's going to do when he goes into hell, goes into Hades or the grave for 3 days. He's doing this under the sign of Jonah. So you have this idea that this monster swallows the sinner, and in Jesus' case, he escapes. But that's not always the case. And some of this this sort of thing comes from, we already had this in pre-Christian, in the classical civilization, had this idea of monsters swallowing mortals as a way to enter hell, Hades, or Tartarus, or whatever the classical afterlife was. Just looking through notes on the show, I saw from an illustration from Aeneas going into the underworld, and it's represented by a monster swallowing him, which is identified as Orcus, which is Orcus was sort of an all-purpose monster from the Romans that survived into the Middle Ages. It was kind of always unclear what it was in different stories. It was some sort of giant or a boar. And in the Middle Ages, it kind of evolved, that term evolved into the word ogre, which is also kind of a nebulous kind of monster, and also the wild man of the woods. In northern Italy, there's even something called Parco dei Monstri, which is the garden of the Park of the Monsters, which was a sort of folly that was built by a 16th century nobleman, and he has an orcus. Has an open mouth that you would walk into. So the idea of this monster swallowing people was part of the mouth idea, the hell mouth. It's not just a portal or a gate or a wormhole. It's actually a beast swallowing you.
Wow.
So when you want to curse someone away, you could say go to whale instead of go to hell. It's somehow still the same thing. That's neat. I noticed. One of the things that kind of serendipitously or synchronicity made me, really pay attention to this episode was I had just done – I have under the Monster House banner, I have a oft-neglected but beloved podcast called The Horror Podcast, which I'm doing a series on Italian cinema, Italian horror. And I was looking at Lucio Fulci, who did a lot of movies, but he did specifically a series called The Gates of Hell Trilogy. And they keep talking about the seven gates to hell, which I've seen pop up in a bunch of different folklore. There's like an American version tied to Pennsylvania. There's gates of hell all over the world. But this idea that there's seven of them is of interest. Did you run into any of that seven gates of hell when you're doing your research?
You know, you and I had talked about this, and I really wasn't sure. All I had was very abstract, distant references. But I did find something that might have influenced the Fulci's film. By the way, I really enjoyed that episode because I had never heard the term splat stick for splatter slapstick.
Yeah, isn't that neat?
Yeah, I think those sort of describes a genre that I enjoy. Though I'm also not a fan of Fulci movies because I haven't seen them as much as you. But I think that process of kind of adaptation to Fulci was described in your show nicely. So I don't even know. As far as what I understood was that the Seven Gates is only introduced later in the Beyond, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's very peculiar.
Just to clarify, this is Blake with a quick insert here. There's an idea of multiple gates to hell that are mentioned in City of the Living Dead, but not the number seven. In the second film in this series called The Beyond, which has the same scriptwriter and is set in New Orleans, there's supposed to be seven gates, and one's under the cursed hotel where the protagonist is trying to renovate and set up shop. And in the third film of the trilogy, there's no mention of gates of hell at all. And this can all be laid at the feet of screenwriter Dardano Sacchetti, who famously pushed Fulci away from trying to have his films make sense and towards an aesthetic of sensory nightmare where rationality and reason are the first victims before the people start dying at all.
Then I have a theory that might work. Okay, so first of all, I was kind of looking through. I just went on IMDb and put in Hellgate or Hellmouths, or Hell and Portals, I guess is the most generic. And I noticed there were a lot of films coming up in the late 70s and early 80s. Starting with 77, The Sentinel, which is fun. It's got Christopher Walken in it.
And Burgess Meredith, yeah.
Yeah, then Burgess Meredith, yeah. So there's that. Then Amityville Horror kind of has that. And then you got, and then 81 comes to Beyond. Then you got Poltergeist, Ghostbusters, The Gate, Evil Dead kind of has that too. Hellraiser by 87. So you have all these films coming up. But so I think it was kind of something in the air. But beyond that, I think that there might be a tie to voodoo folklore, voodoo teachings or beliefs, because there's something in voodoo called the Gates of Guinea or Guinan sometimes. Guinan or Guinea is a generic term that's used to refer to all of West Africa where the slaves came from. So it kind of came to mean the realm of the ancestors, the realm of the dead. There were seven gates. There were seven, and you had to do them in the correct order, and you had to leave an offering to the Loa that as you made your way through the different gates. And I wonder if the I got a feeling that the screenwriter for that film, you know, did look into some kind of voodoo folklore, maybe. I mean, it was also, you know, this seven gates thing, as you pointed out, is already like kind of circulating as kind of urban legend status. I don't know how old this Gates of Guinea stuff is. A lot of this voodoo stuff comes in the 20s and 30s. But there are, so it goes, it sort of seems to have evolved from a kind of ritual, a sequence of ritual events now I know there's some kind of urban folklore about New Orleans where there are seven gates to be found throughout the city. You know, Madame Laveau's tomb, of course, is one of them, but there are seven gates that you pass through in order to get to the other side. So that's my guess, that that the screenwriter had looked into that sort of folklore. I don't know. What do you think about that?
That sounds very plausible to me, but yeah, and it'd be really cool if I could speak Italian, because the screenwriter for those movies is still alive, but I've never found any interview where he talks about that, and that's really disappointing. I'd love to know.
May not disclose his secrets too.
But exactly.
Maybe that was the concept, and it didn't make it its way really clearly into the script, and Fulci had no idea
I mean, and yeah. When you look at the third movie, is The House by the Cemetery, it's got nothing to do with Gates of Hell at all. So yeah. I don't know.
Al, I want to ask you about Gates to Hell in a more kind of pop culture sense, because when Blake first mentioned this topic to me, that's what I thought of. I was thinking more about Gates to Hell as a kind of legend tripping thing, and it seems to be really popular nowadays that people will go to cemeteries and other spooky places and they'll discover a portal to hell. And Blake some time ago did an investigation into one of these places, and there'll be claims about satanic rituals taking place and all different kinds of things. But well, what do you know about that kind of pop culture interpretation of Gates to Hell today?
You know, I almost wonder if some of that was influenced because this legend tripping sort of started once kids got their cars after World War II and started all that kind of youth culture stuff that began. So it's all relatively recent.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww. Yeah.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
Thing done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
I don't know that the one I know the best. I know there's probably dozens of them now. I know the one I know the best is the one in Pennsylvania, in York County. There's a road, Toad Road, which So there's a there's the sort of generic legend, tripping legend that there was a mental hospital out there that burned down, and all the patients escaped. And they one version of the story is they put up gates to keep the crazy dangerous mental patients in, and another version, and I don't think actually the Gates of Hell story I think doesn't have that much to do with it. The other is just you have to pass through these gates. I think you can only see the first one during the day and the other six appear at night, and then you can get to the other side. I guess Toad Road, the road that used to go down, that they used to legend trip down, is now like overgrown and closed off. But the funny thing is, it seems to have been a road to 19th century iron forge. And I think the forge eventually burned down, which, like the mental hospital, I guess there's some symmetry in all of
it. That's
a good source on that is Timothy Renner, who does the Strange Familiars podcast. He wrote a book, I think, on Toad Road. But that's just one of them. I know there's a lot. Like, I don't know what the Skull Cemetery story is.
Blake can tell us about that, but it seems like it's a very popular thing in America, maybe not so much in Australia. But certainly every town, city I've gone to in the States has had some kind of gate to hell.
Right. Like there's like 12 crying baby bridges to all this legend tripping stuff kind of just, and now it travels via the internet. It used to be, you know, oral histories or oral transmission.
Right.
Now it's everywhere.
Well, it's kind of the reason I was looking at Goat Man again. Why haven't we covered Goat Man? Because we need to cover him as a broad category. There's so many Goat Men across America, you know, and I understand goat herding is a lonely business. So things happen. Sometimes it doesn't pan out. Sometimes it terribly pans out. So
maybe Blake, you can tell us a little about it if we have time.
I can tell you quickly about in 2010. By the way, oh my God, time flies. I went to visit. It was at the Midwest Skeptics. Oh, actually, I was on a business trip. It doesn't really matter. I went to visit the Midwest Skeptics. I don't know if they're still a group or not, but I went out to dinner with them. And, you know, every time I go on a business trip, I always try to find something to investigate. And I ask, you know, well, what are the local legends? What do people do out here? You know, where's the ghosts? Where's the monsters? And nobody really had a great answer, but someone suggested that there is a gate to hell in Stull. And I had never heard of it before.
It's just Stull.
It is a really cute little town. I bless their hearts. It turns out that I went out there, and when I got there, there was someone chasing teenagers away from the cemetery. And I parked, and when they were leaving, I flagged them down because I assumed they were authorities of some sort. They were. I don't want to, you know, call them out or whatever. But I stopped to talk for about half an hour about the problems they were. And it turns out according to them, in the 1950s, some professor at the University of Kansas made up this folklore as a deliberate urban legend. By 1972, it had become a popular thing for teenagers to do on Halloween night was to go see the gate to hell open and Satan to come out. And so, of course, in the 70s, hippie movement, all that sort of thing, it got really raucous. And people started vandalizing the cemetery. By the time I had done this chat with him, they had had 13 broken headstones and 11 had been completely stolen. And it's a small community. When people steal headstones or break headstones, it's impacting families that still live there, you know? So, right. Unfortunately, it's got a real dark side to it. But, you know, there is no gateway there. And then, of course, it got popularized on the TV show Supernatural. And so they've just been struggling with trying to keep people from vandalizing their cemetery. So, sadly. No gate to hell, but lots of terrible, hellish behavior from the normals. So,
yep.
Well, Al, we can, you know, obviously gates to hell and all that lore, maybe something we could explore further later. I know Jerry Drake's done a lot of research on Toad Road and has been anxious to talk about it. We could probably hook up something with him. But I want to talk about these classical, mythological, medieval, religious, the big gates to hell, the ones that like fill up medieval documents with beautiful paintings. Tell us about, you know, some of these early, like, where do we first get these stories from? When did the gates of hell start entering Western literature?
One of the earliest ones that's really fully fleshed out, it would be Virgil's the Aeneid, where he visits hell to get information about, he needs to seek the advice of his dead father. And at the entrance of hell is one of the Sibyls who kind of gives him directions of how to proceed into the underworld. The Sibyls were 9 or 10, depending if you're a Greek or Roman, how many Sibyls were there. The oracles that were mainly in Greece and Italy, but also scattered through like Turkey and modern Iran and Libya. They were all over. But the most important one was the Cumaean Sibyl. Cumaea was a Greek colony near Naples, more or less. In Virgil's story, he goes to her and he's sort of set on the underworld road by her. But they've always, you know, since the Middle Ages, people were always wondering where that cave she lived, you know, in her underground lair was supposed to have been. And in 1932, an Italian archaeologist, Maiori, who he's overseen excavations at Pompeii and Herculaneum. He decided that he had found the location because he found this long tunnel that had a large chamber at the end. And what really clinched the deal for him was it was near Lake Avernus, which was mentioned in the in Virgil's story. Virgil calls it the something like the foul smelling Lake of Avernus. And Avernus is from a Greek word that means birdless. And the reason there was this lake was birdless is it was fed by from underground. There were underground fissures that let off carbon dioxide, which would poison the birds if they flew low enough. So that's kind of been locked in since the 30s as a location. And I'm actually excited. I'm going to be going to Naples and for some stuff in the spring. And I'm going to go definitely have to check that out and see if I agree. It looks like a gate to hell. So that's one of the ones that one of the several that actually correspond with real world locations. There's also in Turkey, there's the Temple of Pluto in Hierapolis, which also has it's another case where there is supposed to have been toxic gases leaking up through fissures in the earth. And this is also an area where the priests of Cybele were supposed to, run things for a while, their mystery cult. And they would, the cave was known, the temple had was attached to a cavern. People would new sacrifices would be offered there, and they sacrifice the animals by lowering them down into this pit that where they were exposed to these fumes. And the priests of Cybele would go enter the cave, but they would keep their heads low enough so that they would be below where the carbon dioxide would accumulate. Carbon monoxide, sorry, would accumulate, so they would actually survive. And then they would, so they'd lie on the ground, then they'd rise up, and then they would be miraculously endowed with some sort of supernatural power. So that was gave them sort of that sort of status that they might not have had otherwise. And there's even then there's also even in Turkey, I think it's Turkey, no, it's in Greece. There's another temple of the dead in Ephra. People would seek out an oracle there in the Odyssey. Odysseus goes there to talk to Tiresias, and another case where they would offer animal sacrifices, and that there's ruins of that also that people can go to. So, you know, there's a number of entrances to the underworld of antiquity that you could look for.
Yeah, it seems like they're tied to these sort of geological. It's like the classic euhemerous thing was there must be a kernel of truth to this myth. And sometimes when they're tied to these geological places, it does seem like a really good fit that these gas leaks or whatever emissions would kind of need a narrative to explain them. And these fit the bill, right?
And I suppose that, you know, there was something special going on there that didn't happen. You know, it's like sort of like Children of the Damned or something. You walk into the zone and everybody freezes or falls down asleep or dies. It's like, well, how do we explain this? Yeah, I think it's sort of natural. Those become supernatural or sort of liminal zones.
Yeah. Those lakes that occasionally burp out carbon dioxide. And I think there's one in Africa that killed a village because it was downhill from the lake, and then they've put vents in it now to kind of keep it hopefully cut down on those kind of massive all at once emissions. But it's very frightening.
Happens in Yellowstone too. Heard stories about that, and animals dying in particular. But I'm curious about the intersection between fairy lore and Hellmouth lore. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that has to do with we have so much folklore about dwarves and trolls living, dwarves especially, I suppose, living, or fairies living in caves and in the depths of a mountain. One of them is another Sybil. As I said, there were 10 or 9 or 10 of them. This is the Apennine Sybil. It's up a little further north of Naples in Umbria. In the Apennine Mountains, there's the mountain range called the Sibyllini Mountains, and Mount Sibylla would be where people believed that this fairy who had become sort of a gatekeeper to the underworld existed. There's a sort of, I think it's a 15th century story about a visit to this fairy, which also another thing that gave sort of lent credence to the story was it was near the town of Norcia, which in the Middle Ages was known as a kind of mecca for sorcery. And again, it's next to a lake. Lago di Pilato is called, it's the Lake of Pilate, Pontius Pilate from the Bible story, responsible for crucifying Christ, supposedly. So he was a villain of the Middle Ages. And the lake was colored blood red. Again, some other kind of geological phenomenon. I'm not sure how it's explained, but there's something significant about the lake. And so this knight, Guerin, in this 15th century narrative, visits not the Sybil, Alcina, in her underground palaces and pleasure gardens and so forth. And he can't leave. And so that's kind of, you know, that's a narrative you have in a lot of fairy lore, where once the fairies capture you, you have to stay, and, you know, you stay forever. You have no access to the real world.
Oh, golly. I thought you were going to say there was a gate to hell there, because I thought if the gates to hell are tied to Leviathan, and this is a tale of Pontius Pilate, surely that would create a pilot whale.
God, you must work so hard on this.
Set up.
The thing about that story that's interesting is it was kind of the basis for the Tannhäuser story, which is more or less the same, the one that Wagner adapt into his opera, and so that became well known. And you know, in Blade Runner, when Roy Batty,
I sure do.
Yeah, so that's the same gate we're talking about in that story, but it's just the German version of the story. It's the gate to the other side.
Oh, cool.
That story's lost to us like tears in the rain. So
yeah. In the 2000s, they did some studies with ground penetrating radar, and they found that at Mount Sibylla, the caverns actually go much, much deeper into the mountain than was suspected before the cave entrance itself was collapsed at some point, I think maybe intentionally. But so you never know. That might be an avenue to pursue if you want to go to Fairy Kingdom.
Probably try to start to wrap things up with the interview. But I wanted to ask you, what's coming up for your show, and are there any other projects that you want folks to know about?
My show is, I guess we're in the fifth year now, episode 104 I'm working on.
Yay.
So, it struggles on, or it's not a struggle to the listeners, but it's certainly a struggle to me sometimes. And I'm also working on another
book. We understand.
Book, I'm sure you do. Kind of related to the Krampus book. It's, looking at, the Krampus was a winter holiday. So this one looks at unknown folk celebrations, that occur between, the carnival season and May Day. And I'm finding lots of really, really good stuff. So that it's going to still be a while, more than a year before that comes out, but I'm spending a lot of time researching that.
Fun. Oh, good luck with that.
You've been here before. And we talked about your favorite monster. So I thought I would say, if you want to, if that's changed, you could talk about a new favorite monster. Or maybe you could introduce us to something a little obscure that you like, or just something the listeners may not have heard of before.
Well, one of the things that – a monster that did come to mind because it just sort of fell in with the notes, the research I was doing, was the Chimera, monster from Greek mythology. Because I actually visited the Chimera's lair, at least according to some stories, when I was in Turkey. There's a site on the southern coast. It's on the slopes of another Mount Olympus. There's 20 something of them apparently across the globe, but they call this Olympus, spelled a little differently. There is gas that again here issues up from within the earth, and it tends to burst into flames. So this rocky area has all these flames burning perpetually. I guess in one of the accounts, they talk about the Chimera being continually on fire day and night. So these flames are how they're looked upon, at least in the folklore of the region. And I remember burning sticks to say that they were sticks that were used to battle the Chimera, and giving them out as souvenirs at the time. So that was one that came to mind. But I do have a question, sort of a request for your listeners. If there's any listeners who lived in Tennessee, perhaps, or anywhere near Tennessee, when I was a kid, I remember going to, and this would have been a long time ago, probably the early 70s or early 70s. We're driving through the Smoky Mountains, which is, very built up for sort of, they call it the White Trash Riviera around that area. So it's very built up for tourism. And there was an attraction. I didn't know what the name was. It was, but I started doing some research. It was called Tour Through Hell, opened in 67. And it was,
whoa,
I remember was it looked like a sort of like a Flintstones village. It looked like sort of a big fiberglass volcano. And it was kind of like a carnival attraction you'd walk through, and you were led by a preacher who would talk about different sinners and what they did historically to be suffering there. And there were red lights, and it was spooky, and my parents were kind of dubious about the whole thing. But I remember going there and enjoying it. It burned down in the early 70s. Again, I guess sort of appropriate.
Yeah.
So Gatlinburg. So if anybody's ever been to that and has any information, I would love to hear more about it. Especially, I'd love to see a photo. I was too young to be taking photos, but it does, lives on in my memory fondly.
Oh, I bet you'll get some answers from our audience.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
I thought I might. Yeah.
Were you just visiting Tennessee, or is that where you're from?
No, I lived in Kentucky for a while, so Kentucky. That's where we went.
Gotcha. Yeah, okay. Cool. Yeah, no, I never heard of that. I actually just went down a research hole this past summer because I ran into this bit of trivia. I'm really interested in the history of the internet and technology and that sort of thing. And I saw that like a really important developmental step in the internet took place at a conference in Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Oh,
and I couldn't believe it because I'm like, if you've been to Gatlinburg lately, you know, in my lifetime, it does not seem like the sort of place where there would be high end tech conferences and
Hollywood and
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So golf.
I ran that to ground. I found the answer to my question. And but I can put a little insert here about that if anyone's interested. But it was really interesting because I thought that is an underplayed bit of when you think about the history of Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge and all that stuff, pioneering moments of internet history does not come to mind.
No, not exactly.
But it's true. So I'll stick an answer. Anyway, Al, thank you so much for coming to talk to us in our audience today.
Yeah, thank you. Really interesting topic.
Yeah, and I listeners, I highly recommend you check out Al's show. It is so well produced. It's such a fun ride, and you'll learn stuff every time, guaranteed.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You just heard an interview with podcaster and author Al Ridenour. A link to Al's show and book are in the show notes, and be sure to check them out. Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative and The Sit Down. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. You can enjoy extended commercial-free versions of this show by joining us at patreon.com/ Monster Talk, all one word, MONSTERTALK. For as little as $2 a month, you can enjoy longer interviews, unbleeped language, and bonus episodes exclusive for patrons. And if $2 a month is not workable for you, but you still want to help out, be sure and leave us a positive review on your podcasting platform of choice. iTunes reviews in particular can help bring in new listeners, and your positive reviews really make a difference. If you want to learn other ways to help out, visit monstertalk.org/support, where you can find even more ways to help keep this show going. Thank you to all of you who are supporting us with your hard-earned money and valuable time. We are humbled and grateful and hope that we always live up to or even exceed your expectations. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Your attention is rare and precious, and we thank you for sharing some of it with us this week.
Been a Monster House presentation.